Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to Spotcast, Season 6, Episode 19. My name is Jonathan Kuhlein, and I am in Mississauga, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr., live from Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
It's going good. So our usual host, the magnificent Tim, is away this week, but we just could not resist the urge to get into this great Star Trek Strange New Worlds, Star Trek Lower Decks crossover episode. So we're going to go through our usual stuff, and then we're going to have a good talk about that, which I thought was a really great episode. So let's kick things off with a fact check. I'm reading Tim's fact check, so please don't back check my fact check, but we'll go through these. Let's see, he's got written down, Jaime is on the right channel and Tim is on the left. Does that mean I'm the center channel?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like that fact check requires more fact check.
Or just a check. There's something in there. Well, we can always circle back on that one next time we record. We were talking about Day of the Jackal on our previous episode, and Tim wanted to point out that Edward Fox played the Jackal in Day of the Jackal, the 1973 film. We were also talking about the ongoing labor strife in Hollywood, and he was mentioning different people who were talking about their residuals and some of the issues that they've been facing with not being fairly compensated for their work. And he mentioned Denise Crosby was the person who posted her check from her appearances on Ray Donovan, and was not exactly impressed with what she was getting for the work that she put in and how that compares. And as a matter of fact, I actually saw a follow-up to that. I saw Will Wheaton posting this week talking about how his Star Trek The Next Generation residuals were really what kept him afloat, because his parents apparently took his money when he was a boy. And so he said he got more in residuals. He got enough on his residuals to live versus some of the people now who can barely make their health insurance doing their residuals based on the new models. So yeah, big difference.
Right.
And the other person that Tim had mentioned was, we've got a story here from Decider, where Kimiko Glenn, who was one of the stars of Orange is the New Black, was talking about how, you know, she's not really making a lot in residuals from her appearance. She was in 44 episodes of Orange is the New Black. She played the character Brooke, So-So. And she posted the fact that she is bringing in her royalties statement for this, I guess, for this last month was $27.30. Which, when you compare that to what we just talked about with Will Wheaton, being able to make, you know, pretty significant amounts of monies off of residuals for shows shot in the 80s, that's a pretty poor amount of money to try and, you know, scrape together to live off of.
Yeah, the family-friendly version of the title here is that she's justifiably upset that her breasts live on in perpetuity after only making $27 in residuals for that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, obviously, that doesn't factor in the fact that she did get paid in the moment, but as far as, you know, the way things used to be versus the way things are, and obviously the amount of profits that these very large corporations are taking in, and it does continue to paint a picture of inequity that clearly needs to be addressed. So hopefully we will see some kind of resolution to that. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking a little bit about the box office and the television world as we go through our stuff today, which leads us to our headlines. And Jaime's up first with our headlines.
Yeah, this is a really strange, you know, partial week. As we're recording here, we're recording on a different day because of the surprise, or at least it was a surprise to me. We didn't mention it on the show, so I assume it was a surprise to everyone that we got a new episode of Strange New Worlds off cycle. Apparently we're going to continue to get a regular one on the regular cycle. And as part of this whole slew of things are a couple of sort of big things that were announced. So we got a trailer for the, not this episode we're going to talk about, but the subsequent episode entitled Subspace Rhapsody. It's the musical episode that I think we had we'd known about, but didn't know where it was going to be. And honestly, we were rapidly running out of time, so it had to be one of the next ones, right? And here it is.
Yeah.
Coming on August 3rd with the premise of, you know, space anomaly causes everyone to sing and dance and do musical numbers in universe. So what'd you think of the trailer here?
I mean, it looks kind of nutty. Obviously we'll talk in a few minutes about the Strange New Worlds Lower Decks crossover, which was part animated, part live action, and, you know, crossed over characters. So we saw our Strange New Worlds characters animated, we saw our Lower Decks characters in live action. I thought that's a bit of a stretch, but you know what, it worked. The musical episode, again, I'm a Buffy fan, so I've seen the live sort of musical version of a beloved sci-fi program, and that worked surprisingly well. The idea there being that, you know, a demon has cursed them and therefore they all have to break into song and dance. I'm actually kind of surprised when I saw the premise that this hadn't been done before. But it looks fun and funny, and boy, I hate to bet against Strange New Worlds this year. They really are on a streak. This might go down as an all-timer for this one season. They really swung for the fences and have had a lot of home runs this year.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that has been sort of bandied about as a problem with sort of new Trek as a very broad brush, it's not totally true, because, you know, I think when folks say, like, hey, you know, new Star Trek is a little too grimdark, they're not talking about Lower Decks. They're not talking about underneath the surface of Prodigy. They're mostly talking about, you know, first couple of seasons of Picard for sure, and, you know, most seasons of Discovery. And so this feels like it's something that could have been a take me out to the holosuite kind of episode of, like, we're going to do something kind of offbeat and a little bit funnier and is a little bit lighter. And I think the tone of Strange New Worlds has generally been fairly light and a lot more like older Trek in that respect. So I think it hits a good balance where this one fits a little bit more comedic. I'm sure that will be important in some way, in the way that Strange New Worlds make sure that just about every episode has some arc story elements going through. So I have seen some weird backlash of, like, you know, not my Trek. It's like, well, which one is it? Is it grimdark Star Trek Discovery, or is it musical episode Strange New Worlds? Because, like, you got to pick one. It's got to be somewhere in that range. And I think people just maybe like to complain, but I like to enjoy when they do some of this oddball stuff.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they can't have it both ways. If it's too dark, then, you know, is it now flipped? Is it too light? Like, what are they looking for? I don't really understand. I think maybe the people who are complaining should go watch reruns of The Orville and leave the rest of us alone to enjoy this great work. What else you got for us?
we were wondering, like, when in the world is Lower Decks Season 4 going to premiere? And it looks like it's just been announced here. We have the trailer in the show notes, so those of you transporting at home, September 7th. At least on Paramount Plus. I assume it's the same day of, or like Crave and etc.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's the expectation. Yeah. Yeah, so not too long. I mean, we're going to get a lot of crossover. So for people who are our faithful listeners, and we appreciate every one of you, we'll go from our wrapping up our season of Strange New Worlds into covering Ahsoka, and then from there straight into Lower Decks. And yeah, we'll have some Star Trek Wars sci-fi goodness for you for a few months to come. So yeah, and it looks... I mean, again, it's up until this season, I would have said Lower Decks was a slam dunk as my favorite Trek show. Although, as I said, Strange New Worlds has definitely upped its game to put it really, really neck and neck. But Lower Decks is super fun. And just it seems like the longer they spend with these characters, the more fun they're having. And I thought last season was a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to seeing what they come up with. The trailer made me laugh out loud. So it sounds great.
Yeah, a couple things that I noticed that weren't like really Easter eggs. They were very obvious. So we have the loose cannon Vulcan ensign joining the Cerritos this season. And we also have a mention from Mariner of like, oh, what about that Pike thing we don't talk about, which is a reference to this episode that we're going to talk about this week.
Yep, it's all coming together. It's good, though. I mean, it's funny because even though Prodigy and Lower Decks are animated series and very different animated series at that, it's nice that they can bring them into the fold. You don't feel like it's completely removed just because Lower Decks is a comedy and Prodigy was aimed at younger audiences. I don't like the idea that animation is a lesser than, you know, irrespective of Star Trek, Star Wars, anything else. I'm really happy that... You know, Lower Decks is, it's canon, and it's, you know, yeah, it's definitely a lighter take on Star Trek, but it's definitely belongs with Star Trek. It belongs with the other series. It's not an other or a, oh, but that doesn't count kind of thing. So it's good. I'm glad it's all coming together.
Yeah, I have seen some folks on the interwebs say, well, Lower Decks, it's not canon. People usually respond, well, what do you mean? Like, where did they say it wasn't? And it's like, well, but animation and look at the way they act. It's like, I think this week's episode of Strange New Worlds just really puts that to bed, right? It says, nope, canonically, these characters exist. They cross-reference each other. It's not some weird Elseworlds type of thing. It's like, nope, prime timeline, everything here happens. So,
yeah,
there you go.
Well, and it wouldn't make sense otherwise. I mean, we always talk about Lower Decks is, you know, an opportunity for the writers there, the show creators, who talk about how much they love Star Trek. It really is. As much as it's a comedy series, it's an homage. It's a love story. It's a love letter to Star Trek. There's so many references. We always talk about the fun Easter eggs and things that they stick in there. You know, I don't want people to think of it as lesser than. It's, you know, even in this episode that we're going to talk about in a few minutes, it's very clear that it's all about respect and love for what has come before. So yeah, I'm glad it's not othered. I'm glad it's not stuck in a corner. What you got next?
The nice people over at Netflix have a official trailers. I think we've gotten teaser trailers before, and this is apparently the official trailer for the live-action One Piece series streaming August 31st. And I am personally only tangentially aware of One Piece. It's one of those anime that has like a bazillion episodes. So it's rather intimidating to get into if like you wanted to start from the first episode. Like you'd have to be professionally binging. and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that. Would you have to be like, I am committed to watching like 10,000 episodes kind of thing. So it's so popular that, you know, even somebody who hasn't watched it like me, like I kind of know the general gist. I kind of know some of the characters because they're just so popular, like Dragon Ball Z or Bleach or
Avatar,
Naruto. Like there's a bunch of other ones of like, even if you didn't actually watch the show, it just becomes part of the fabric of sort of fandom, so to speak.
Yeah.
The response seems pretty positive so far. People are like feeling a lot more hype about this than they were around Cowboy Bebop or Death Note and others.
That's my question to you is, how do you feel about the overall trend of turning? I mean, obviously, a lot of things. We've seen a lot of cartoon series turned into, you know, we've seen the Transformers, we've seen G.I. Joes, we've seen lots of things that were cartoons turned into television series. I'm not sure how I feel about the anime stuff, just because a lot of it is very imaginative. It's really, really, it's what makes it amazing in a lot of cases is the really fun animation, the color. It just is such a specific form of art that doing the live action, I don't know, something just feels like I have never seen one where I'm like, wow, that is like, you know, perfect. Now, admittedly, I haven't watched every single thing, but I don't know. Do you feel like turning out live action stuff compared to the anime is working or is a trend that's worth continuing?
That's a really tough one because it's an area where I don't know enough about the like anime to live action conversions because it tends to happen way more over in like Japan. So I just don't have enough experience with that. But if we expand sort of the lens out a little bit and say, okay, so what about Disney? And Disney's been on a tear of like, let's just take all our animated properties and remake them, reboot them as live action. They've had some hits and they had some misses. So it maybe isn't necessarily like a bad idea outright. It does make you wonder, like, well, how are you going to make something successful? Because you're definitely going to be judged on, is it exactly a translation from animation, almost like a transcription of animation to live action, which is really tough because you get a lot of expressiveness out of the animation that it would just look weird and goofy 9 times out of 10 in live action. And yet you'll also have people like, well, if you're just going to do that, then why do I even need to watch this? Why don't I just watch the original? So there's a really fine line of feeling like you're authentically keeping in line with what people expected, but giving them just a little bit of sizzle on the steak that surprises them. Say, oh, I didn't expect that. Okay, that's actually maybe not better because people always feel really nostalgic about the source material, but like that is a legitimate new take on a favorite thing. This is my comfort meal, and then you threw a little bit of sea salt on it, and it just changed it, right? So, and in this case, the One Piece main character is like a Mr. Fantastic Plastic Man kind of thing. So this is like hard mode. They didn't choose a slice of life anime of like, oh, these are just regular high schoolers. It's like, nope, this is a world where fishmen exist, and the main character stretches himself, punches people from like 20 feet away. Like they definitely had to spend money on this, and it's a way harder thing to do than a bunch of other things they could have done. So I guess we'll see, but so far people are feeling pretty hype. As I mentioned, it is an anime that is still ongoing and has a bazillion episodes, so I'm sure somebody at Netflix said, oh, we can continue making this for like the next 30 years. Okay, sure. Why not? As long as people want it. But realistically, are they going to have to condense, you know, more than just condense a season into a season? It might be a few different seasons into a season, especially if there's any like filler. Like, oh, yeah, I just kind of skip like these 20 episodes because nothing really happens. You know, that sort of thing that often happens to these long running shows.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It does look like fun. That definitely looks like a fun series. I was keeping track of the box office this weekend because we got our big Barbenheimer weekend. We got Barbie, the Barbie movie, and Oppenheimer starting at the same time. And apparently it was a huge weekend for the box office. So this was two movies combined, but they combined to make the fourth biggest weekend of all time in the North American box office. So that's Canada and the United States. And, you know, it was a big weekend. $162 million US is what they brought in collectively. Barbie was the bigger, pretty much a 2-to-1 ratio. Now, that checks out because it's a lot more sort of easily accessible film compared to Oppenheimer. And it's also not 3 hours of commitment to it as well. And Oppenheimer is, pardon the pun, a slow burn. I think it will probably play for a little while in the theaters, and I think a lot of people will see it over the next little while, whereas Barbie felt like more of an event. I think a lot of people were out wearing their Barbie outfits. They did a really wonderful job on the marketing, so a lot of people were out there wearing their pink clothes and having a good time. I went on Monday night to go see the Oppenheimer movie with my son, and we had a great time, and while we were there, we saw countless people dressed up in not necessarily costumes, like it's not like Comic-Con, but it was definitely a loving effort that people put in to go and see the Barbie movie together. Tim went to go see Oppenheimer on the weekend, and he was posting pictures of groups of young women all dressed up in pink, and some of them dressed very Barbie-esque. So yeah, it's interesting that, you know, these are two movies that aren't what we talk about a lot, which is sort of these event tentpole franchise movies. These are original stories. They haven't been done before. They are sort of the exception nowadays. You know, a lot of stuff is building on IP. It's, you know, and of course there is an IP component to Barbie, but you know, there's never been a product based on this character in the theaters before. So yeah, it was a pretty interesting to see that the crowds came out, and not just the crowd that comes out to go see a Star Wars movie or a Marvel movie or Indiana Jones or whatever it is, but this, you know, attracted, I think, a different crowd. And Oppenheimer's the same way. I mean, you know, it's a very, very watchable film, but it's also long and it's, you know, dense, and it's Christopher Nolan. So he's, you know, slow and taking his time through it. It's not necessarily something everybody's into, and yet everybody seemed to be into it. So yeah, it was an interesting weekend to see all this come together.
Yeah, the fourth biggest weekend all time at the domestic box office is pretty astounding. People were talking about this being another one of those movie pairings that like saves cinema yet again, right? I'm gonna guess there were not people dressed for Oppenheimer. There weren't people in like 40s gear. People weren't dressing as Oppenheimer or, you know, assorted things.
That would have been possibly inappropriate.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably a whole lot easier. Yeah. Like, I'm assuming the theater, wherever you went, had like the popcorn special, you know, gift popcorn tin that you could buy that it's like bright pink. They probably didn't have like Oppenheimer tins, I would guess.
No. And that's, again, I think that speaks to the interesting nature of this. There was a ton of Barbie merch around. They had a lovely, like a Barbie doll box that people could climb into and take their pictures. They had, you know, Barbie branded popcorn tins and all that kind of stuff. And so it was a real event, and it was playing in multiple cinemas. We were going to go see the 70 millimeter print, the film version of Oppenheimer, which of course is, you know, just means it's in the biggest theater and everything. But I mean, it was packed wall to wall. There was no seats. It was, you know, completely full up right up to the front. And if you're sitting in front of, and we were in front of a huge IMAX screen, if you were sitting there, I don't even know, like it was a lot to take in. But yeah, it's interesting how those two movies are so different and yet somehow worked. And I think a lot of people bought into the like, oh, we'll watch them both at the same time or back to back, kind of, you know, make an event out of it, do the whole Barbenheimer thing. It was, it was fun to see. I went on a Monday night. We got there at about 9:30 p.m. I was there with my son and my cousin. We went to go watch it together. And it just, there was an electricity in the crowd. People were excited to go see Barbie. People were excited to go see Oppenheimer. It just felt non-obligatory, if that makes sense. You know, it feels like a lot of the movie watching that we have done the last number of years is like, well, I have to go watch the new Marvel movie because if there's a new Marvel movie, or I have to go see the new, you know, franchise, insert franchise here movie because it's part of this, you know, Mission Impossible or Top Gun or whatever. Mm-hmm. It feels like there's been this sort of obligation, whereas this was joyful. It felt like people were just there and really excited to be back in the movie theater. I think a lot of people were, this was their sort of first trip back to the movies in a while. And in timing wise, again, coming out of, you know, mid July, you're like, well, mid July, are people around? But yeah, it was packed and people were having a good time. All right, we'll move on to the Eisner Awards. So San Diego Comic-Con was this past weekend. That's where we got our great news about all these Star Trek content. And we also got the Eisner Award winners. So the Eisner Awards are essentially the Oscars for comic books. They are the sort of highest honor that is bestowed. And, you know, interesting stuff. You know, there was some... There wasn't just sort of one big takeaway winner from all this. Tom King, who was famously done a great run on Batman and a number of series, won a bunch of different awards this year, including Best Single Issue for Batman One Bad Day, The Riddler. We saw Nightwing, interestingly, won Best Continuing Series. I have not read the new Nightwing series, but I've heard it's really great, so that was interesting. Tom King won for The Human Target for Best Limited Series, along with Greg Smallwood. So some interesting sort of, look at things. Best New Series was Public Domain by Chip Zdarsky. Chip is a Torontonian, so he's here. And so we're always very proud to recognize that. Some of the other stuff that stood out. Oh, Kate Beaton. So I had mentioned Ducks a few episodes back, this memoir about going and working on the oil sands here in Canada. That was a really great read that I enjoyed. She won Best Graphic Memoir, and she also won Best Writer-Illustrator, which I thought was great to see her work recognized, because that's, again, another Canadian. I'm going to keep shouting those out because we got to do what we can. Yeah, it was a nice celebration. We'll have the link in our show notes if you want to have a look through at all the winners. The only thing I will also mention is that there was also some inductions into the Hall of Fame, which is interesting that there's a comic book Hall of Fame. But yeah, so let's see. The judges' choices, Jerry Bales, Tony Zuniga, Justin Green, Bill Griffith, Jay Jackson, Jeffrey Catherine Jones, Jay Katz, Aline Kominsky-Crum, Wynn Mortimer, Canadian, Diane Newman, Gaspar Saladino, Kim Thompson, Gary Trudeau, of course, famously Dunes. Mort Walker and Tatiana Wood. And then the voters' choices I thought were really interesting this year. Brian Bolland, who's a very legendary illustrator, very famous for his covers. Anne Nocenti, who was a longtime writer on Daredevil. Tim Sale, the late Tim Sale, who was one of my all-time favorite artists, did famously The Long Halloween, along with a lot of other works. And Diana Schutz, who was the longtime publisher for Dark Horse Comics, got into the Hall of Fame. So yeah, really interesting list of people, and congratulations to everybody who walked away with comics' highest honors this week.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised that Gary Trudeau has taken so long to get inducted into their Hall of Fame. Is there like a you need to be retired a certain number of years kind of criteria?
I don't think so, because some of these are still working people. I'm not sure what the criteria are for their Hall of Fame. I know I have been involved with the Canadian Comics Awards, which are the Joe Shuster Awards up here, and the criteria is that you have to have been working in the field for a minimum of 20 years. So there may be a minimum amount of time, but I don't know. I don't know what the criteria are, but you're right. I mean, Gary Trudeau, you'd think that that would be a slam dunk, although he doesn't exactly fit into a box because he's more of a cartoonist, and there's a little bit of a... it's not rivalry, but it's sort of a little bit of a push-pull sometimes on the cartoon strips versus comic books. It's still sequential storytelling, but it's kind of different. Mm-hmm. So maybe there was a little bit of that factored in there.
I see. So that would make sense that he's more, to make a sports ball reference, he's the Edgar Martinez DH only, is this person worthy of the Hall of Fame kind of thing, versus a Pete Rose, will he ever be in the Hall of Fame for other, you know, gambling reasons. I wasn't sure if there was like a juicy controversy over Gary Trudeau or Doonesbury.
Well, I don't think so. Again, I don't know what all the personal politics are for all these different things, but yeah, I thought that was Yeah, you're right. I mean, Gary Trudeau has been an influential cartoonist for 40 years, 45 years, like quite a long time. We got more stuff out of Comic-Con. We got our first trailer for Gen V or Gen 5. What do you think we're supposed to call it? We never get that down. Is it Gen V or Gen 5? What do you think we go with?
They're using the V compound, right? So I interpret it as V for the compound. It seemed like we're probably giving it to people, or this is a school for people whose kids got it, and you kind of do this as preparatory school to become, you know, hopefully one of the seven or some other professional superhero. But I didn't really think about the five angle that, you know, I don't know how long this school has been going. Is this the fifth gen of, of this school? Fifth year? Fifth school? I wonder, and that's something we'll have to keep an eye out for, is like, is there a little bit of double meaning behind the title?
Yeah, maybe. The trailer is everything I think you've come to expect from The Boys. So it was bloody, it was funny, it was over the top. And the idea is that this is all set in the same universe. So these are the kids who are all, you know, on their way up and all wanting to be part of the seven, who of course are the sort of Justice League of the Boys universe. And, it does look like fun. I'm definitely in. Did you come away with any different impressions other than, sort of separating it from The Boys, or anything that sort of stood out for you?
It seems fun because it seems like a slightly different sort of take on, what if superheroes are real? What if they're part of corporations? And what would happen? You have younger folks who are trying to be TikTok influencers, like the one guy who's like, I wouldn't pour this on my junk or whatever it is that he says. You know, it's such garbage. He doesn't want to, like, he should be drinking a bit of, taste of a new generation or whatever it is that the slogan is, but it's, you know, utter rubbish as a product and he's struggling to deal with it. Like, that's a realistic thing that people can run into, right? Like, you can definitely tell when your favorite YouTuber really isn't all that hyped up about the sponsor, but they needed to get the lights on.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it looks good. And I have to remember, I checked do you remember what the start date is? It's September. I know I put it in there.
September 29th.
29th. Excellent. Awesome. So yeah, looking forward to that one. Should be a lot of fun. We got a little bit more this week about a new pair of new movies that are coming from DC Animation, and interesting ones at that. So they're going to do animated feature films of Watchmen and Crisis on Infinite Earths. So Watchmen, we've obviously seen an interpretation of it as the Zack Snyder version of the film that came out a number of years ago. And Crisis on Infinite Earths, we've never seen sort of a definitive one. We've seen them adapt it in the Arrowverse, the Green Arrow, Flash, Supergirl combined CW universe. But I don't think we've ever seen one that's sort of a definitive interpretation. I will be really curious to see how faithful to the source material both of these are going to be, because both of those have had interpretations that are not exactly bang on, and that kind of a bit diminished what was happening. So I'll be curious to see how they come out with these. Are you interested in either of these as animated products, or have a particular affection for either of them?
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. I mean, it's kind of a weird let me feel sad. Watchmen is not a happy series of product, and Crisis on Infinite Earth isn't exactly happy either. So kind of an interesting choice here for them. Some more serious works. I'll be interested to see the animated Watchmen, because there were complaints about some of the changes made to the live action version that probably wouldn't have worked too well if they were a bit more faithful. So seeing something that through animation can afford to be more faithful will be interesting. And the Crisis on Infinite Earths is one that, you know, I think that could work out really well, because that was such a seminal series that it just feels like it needs animation, I think, for this case, because we haven't gotten to the point where we can do in DC live action the this is the Infinity War, Infinity Gauntlet kind of equivalent, right? Mm. So rather than waiting multiple years for that potential thing to happen, it might be kind of nice to just see the animated version of this.
Yeah, I've enjoyed a lot of the DC animated properties, but some of it, you know, it's funny because you'd think, obviously, it would be a slam dunk to take some of these things like The Long Halloween or The Dark Knight Returns or Watchmen or things that are just sort of these incredibly seminal stories, and you've got the template laid out for you, you already know it has a built-in audience, off you go. But I can't say I loved the live-action Dark Knight. I can't say I loved the live-action Batman Year One. There's certainly parts of them that I really enjoy, but it just didn't quite land for me. So again, I think I'll be curious to see what they do and don't include. And if they are going to go, like for Watchmen, are they going to go full like hard R animated DC? You know, are they going to really make it as gritty and real as the original series?
Yeah, I feel like they've not been afraid to pull punches in the animated movies that I've seen on like HBO Max and stuff. So will they have blue flopping dong? I'm not sure if they'll go that far, but it's not out of the question, I guess.
Well put. Well put. Well, speaking of mature animation, we also got the reveal about the new season of Invincible. So we knew we were getting the new season of Invincible this fall. We now know what the timeline is for that. It's coming in September. But we got a little bit more details and we got a little bit of an interesting drop. So we found out that they are going to put out this season. It's coming this fall and they're going to split it in half. So it's coming back on November 3rd. They're going to play 4 episodes and then they're going to take a break. And then they're going to come back in early 2024 with the other 4 episodes from the season. They've also announced that they have done the recordings for the actors for season 3 already. I imagine probably in anticipation of the actors' strike, so that they don't think it'll be as long of a gap between season 2 and 3 as it was between 1 and 2. And they also dropped this interesting origin story, Invincible Adam Eve, that looks into the character Adam Eve, who is one of the prominent characters in season 1. She'll have a bigger role in season 2. And so we got all that all at once. Yeah, interesting that, and that dropped right away. So as soon as they announced Invincible Adam and Eve, it was dropped on Amazon. You can watch it right now. So we got a little something to tide us over. And then, the two-part season coming ahead. I can't say I love the little two-part seasons, especially if it's only going to be 8 episodes, but I'll take what I can get.
Yeah, I wonder why they wouldn't keep it delayed until all episodes are available and ready. I wonder what sort of scheduling hole they're trying to fill there. Because if you know out of the gate that, like, hey, this is going to need to be split, you might as well just keep it until that second half of the season is ready. Certainly during the pandemic, there were some shows and animated shows even that got hit mid-production, and they had this weirdo like year-long gap in between. An intentional one here is a little strange.
Yeah, and it seems particularly strange on a short season, right? Like if you're doing whatever 20 episodes, okay, fine, you know, obviously you can split that 2 and 2. We saw that with Prodigy and stuff, but yeah, the splitting up a season that's as short as 8 episodes is a little unusual. But maybe they need a little extra time to finish them. And I mean, the show has been great. So, and I'm a huge fan of the property, so I'm looking forward to it either way, but it does feel a little weird to do 4 episodes. It's going to take less than a month. And then they take a couple months off and then we get 4 more. It seems strangely spread out, but c'est la vie. We got news of a release date for the John Wick prequel series, The Continental. It's a 3-part series. It is going to be premiering on September 22nd, and it's going to be a The 22nd, the 29th, and then October 6th. So three parts to tell this sort of storyline around this hotel for assassins that is part of the John Wick universe, set in the 1970s. So it's got sort of a little bit of a backstory, origin story, prequel kind of vibe. I think it's safe to say we're not going to see John Wick in this one because it wouldn't make any sense. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how they do this. It's the first sort of real expansion of the larger John Wickiverse. And I hope it does well, because I think there's a lot of stuff to tap into there. What are your thoughts on the John Wick spinoff?
I think I'm interested in the idea. I'm admittedly less interested in it being on Peacock. So I've been...
Yeah.
I don't know, actively avoiding Peacock sounds a little harsh, but... not wanting to deal with yet another streaming service, even though it's not that much money, because it's more like, well, I kind of wish this collapsed into like Prime Video or Netflix or Apple TV Plus or something. I'm kind of thinking to myself whether I will, you know, am I going to try streaming Twisted Metal, or more realistically, am I going to hold off, see what everybody thinks, and then binge it all in 1 month kind of thing?
Yeah, it feels like Peacock is getting closer and closer to the Lopez calculus of a critical mass of things. If you wait for them all to sort of finish airing, you can just sort of get it all for a month and watch it all and then cancel your service again.
Yeah, and it's not even like a traditional calculation of like pricing. In this case, it's more hassle than anything else, which is an odd thing to say for something that I can do from my couch.
Yeah, yeah, really. Yeah, they definitely do make it a little easier now, where you can, yeah, you could sit on the toilet if you wanted to and dial up a new service pretty fast. It's strange how that's all worked out. Got a couple funny things to finish up our headlines. There was a theft on the set of Beetlejuice 2 this last week. Some of the famous sculptures that are seen in the first movie, they brought back and are using it for the second one, and apparently they're shooting this movie in Vermont, and apparently a bunch of the sculptures went missing overnight, and so the police have been, you know, put out a funny tweet that was basically, we tried saying the name of the stolen statues three times, but it didn't come back. They are trying to find these giant statues and see if they can get them back in time to record this thing. Yeah, interesting, funny, sort of quirky story. It's strange to think that people are walking off with these. It says one of them's 150 pounds, these giant sculptures that were decorating them. Although you kind of wonder what security was like on the set there in Vermont. But yeah, interesting that A, this movie's happening, and B, that they're apparently losing their sets as we go.
I'm actually somewhat surprised that this was actually shooting in Vermont when Canada is like right there. And I figured it would be the usual like establishing shots. Like this happens for Seattle all the time, right? Like establishing shots of Seattle. Okay, it's actually Vancouver, right? The nearest, you know, closest regional area. So this would be what, like Montreal, Quebec sort of area?
Yep. Yeah, I don't know what the rationale is. I'm sure, just like all other places, I'm sure Vermont gave them some great tax incentives or whatever that made it a logical place to shoot. And there does have to be a certain aesthetic. I will say that the first Beetlejuice movie did have the town looked a certain way. So maybe they just found a great fit that sort of fit how they wanted to show it. Previously, I can't honestly say I remember where they shot the first one, so maybe they're in the same place. I couldn't say, but we will check on that for fact check for next time.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Or if it's a double agent move of like, I offer, this is going off into the woods here. This is a offer tax breaks. So they come to your area and then you steal their items and sell them on the black market, thus recouping the tax break stuff and giving it back to the people in a really bizarro Robin Hood sort of way.
That is, man, I think you're giving a lot of credit to the municipal governments of Vermont. That's good. That's good.
I thought we were going to have to cut free school lunches for the kids because of those tax breaks. Oh, we found money in the couch cushions. All those kids are fed.
Just don't check our eBay account. And the last funny thing this week, this one is just the weirdest story. So there has been a lament amongst a lot of people who are frustrated that a number of things that are streaming are not available as physical releases. So, for example, we talked about how Willow, they created the Willow spin-off series for Disney Plus. They put it out there. It didn't connect, so they've pulled it off the service. Now you cannot watch it anywhere. So there's still a hunger from a lot of people to sort of protect the things they love by buying a physical copy. Well, one of the things that has never been released physically is any of the Disney Plus Marvel series. So it was interesting to see the headline this week that WandaVision is getting a physical release. I was like, oh, cool. WandaVision is getting a physical release. Well, sort of. They have announced that there's going to be a series of steelbook collectible tins and slipcase versions that are coming out for WandaVision, but that does not include the actual show. I wish I could explain why they're doing this. We've got a story in here from IO9, or Gizmodo, rather, and they have confirmed that they're doing this. This organization called Digital... what's it called? Manta Lab? Manta Lab is the name of the group that's doing it. For as low as $37 US and as high as almost $90 US, you can own these different types of boxes that are basically built to hold your discs, but do not include actual discs of the show. I had a discussion about this with my son, and we were trying to figure out, well, what's the end game here? Is the idea that if you could then, you know, if you had a bootleg copy of it or something, you could then use the cases to sort of put those in. But it's a very, very strange choice to put out these box sets or these cases that do not actually include the physical media. What do you make of all of this?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about the stick a USB thumb drive with a copy of WandaVision that you fell off a truck and you discovered sort of thing. I was thinking about it, I was like, oh, okay, I see it as a, to their point, you don't have the physical media anymore, so you don't have the, oh, look, this Criterion Collection, Crouching Tiger, it's got a really great cover beyond the actual watching of the medium itself. So I could see how this, you know, continues to show your fandom, just like buying a t-shirt or having a Funko Pop or something. So it actually now strikes me as a missed opportunity to bring back something that has fallen to the wayside with streaming media. And that's like commentary. So I don't know what the legality would be around that, but I would love to have like people who worked on the show, directors, actors, whomever, have the commentary that you sync up with the actual show itself, right? Where they go, okay, so start this, you know, record or CD or DVD or whatever it is, like 3, 2, 1, go. And you start that and you start streaming at the same time. And they match up with like, oh, well, right here, if you look in the background, this is where somebody messed up and you can see their head that we decided not to CGI because we figured nobody's like that sort of thing, right? There's like Red Letter Media has that sort of commentary track where they'll have a commentary for like Gremlins 2, the new batch, which clearly they had nothing to mm-hmm. do with, but they sell their MP3 file that you play at the same time that you hit yep. go on your DVD or your streaming media.
Yeah, they do. The creators of Mystery Science Theater 3000 do something now called Riff Tracks, which is the same idea. They basically do audio versions that you can play along with movies that are in the spirit of Mystery Science Theater, where you get them sort of mocking the movie as they go through and watch it along with you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a strange thing to have just a case. And they admittedly, they look lovely. They're very cool. But a case is probably not worth $97 to me.
Yeah, that's pretty hardcore for showing your fandom that way. It's a little bit of a flex, I think.
yeah. Oh, cool. You have the... Hey, wait a minute. There's nothing in here. Well, that's going to bring us to the part of our show where we talk about something Star Trek. In this case, we're going to be talking about Star Trek Strange New Worlds, Season 2, Episode 7, Those Old Scientists, or TOS, if you will. And Jaime, what have you got for your elevator pitch for this week's episode of Star Trek Strange New Worlds?
I have Boimler gets timey-wimeyed into the past to meet the USS Enterprise and must find a way back to the future.
Yeah, I think Back to the Future was right there. I had a similar theme. Boimler and Mariner are warped back to Pike's Enterprise, and it's going to take a lot more than 1.21 gigawatts to get them back to the future. So this was super fun. This was strange, the idea that they start with what looks to be like an episode of Lower Decks. We start on the Cerritos, and then they go down to a planet within the first few minutes of the episode. There is a portal. The portal flares up because of their antics, and Boimler gets sucked through and then finds himself face-to-face with La'an and Spock and Pike in the real world. And of course, Boimler, who is voiced by Jack Quaid, of course, famously Huey from The Boys, is played in this case by Jack Quaid, wearing the same uniform that we see Boimler wearing, with the purple hair and everything. And it's super fun. And from there, it just sort of turns into this, not entirely slapstick, but pretty funny, goofy adventure where Boimler can't resist being Boimler as he's trying to figure out with the crew how to get back to his own timeline, and then over the course of the episode ending up pulling Mariner into his timeline as well. So we get Tawny Newsom playing herself as Beckett Mariner, which was super fun. I thought she was so much fun. I really wish I would take her as a member of the Strange New Worlds crew in a second. She was so much fun. What did you think of the idea of this and how it all came together?
I was actually surprised at how they were unafraid to go between the different mediums. Like, it starts out as ostensibly, like, if you weren't paying attention, you know, you went into the kitchen to make popcorn and your significant other turned on the TV, you'd be like, oh, is this a new episode of Lower Decks? Because it starts there in animated form. They didn't start with animation. Like, animated Boimler goes through the portal and out comes Jack Quaid. And I guess, you know, slight bit of spoilers for the end, we see the Strange New Worlds crew become animated because they're drinking those special Orion drinks.
Yeah.
So it was pretty deftly done there, I think, that I didn't expect that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was potentially, it could have gotten really silly and kind of, it could have been too much like one or the other, but I think it was the right balance of both. I think that's the way that I would look at it.
Yeah, I think they found a way to keep the Lower Decks characters staying as Lower Decks characters and not feeling like Strange New Worlds characters. And they found a way to keep the Strange New Worlds characters as Strange New World characters without feeling like Lower Decks characters. Maybe a little bit of meeting in the middle, but I think Pike, this wasn't one of my quotes, but Pike made it sound like he was taking care of a child because of how enthusiastic Boimler was.
I got that one in the quotes, yeah.
Yeah, and it, that's the right approach, maybe, of like, you know, you're essentially the, you know, the historical heroes to them, to the Lower Decks crew, and they're geeking out, like, oh my gosh, these wonderful things you did, and how amazing it is to see you. That would be a little bit challenging when you're like Pike, and you're like, well, I know what happens to me. I'm assuming this person does too. When you're the Uhura of like, I haven't done anything. Like, I barely have this job to begin with. Right? What do you mean I'm great? And a lot of folks in between, right? We have Nurse Chapel's sort of take on like her relationship with Spock. We have, you know, Una, who's like freaked out of like, crap, this dude is going to end up in like a beeping chair, all burned and disfigured. What the heck happens to me if he's afraid to even look at me? Right? Like, there's a bit of misunderstanding there. So I think that was pretty well handled. It's probably going to be a common thing I'm going to say.
Yeah, for sure. What'd you have for your best pew 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 in this one?
I didn't think of any traditional pew pew pews that I wanted to call out, so I decided to give the award here to the Lower Decks crew banter, where they're like, hey, have you noticed like how slowly everybody talks and how quietly they talk compared to the much more boisterous, animated, quick Rick and Morty-esque style speech patterns that they have on the Lower Decks show?
Yeah, I thought that was a very funny way to sort of show the difference between the two different sort of standards. My pew 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 was the trying to synthesize the ore that they needed to set off this portal. They have Spock being assisted by Boimler, and they are doing this very delicate experiment to try and make it work. And of course, it goes awry and it blows up the workstation that they're working at. And the line from Boimler is, it's supposed to do that? He goes, no, take cover. Like, it just, I thought that was very funny, where they're just sort of, Spock casually walks away and goes and hides behind something as it's about to explode. I thought that was both a very funny moment and also a very, bit of a boom, which you don't always see.
Yeah.
Easter eggs. There was a bunch of stuff. You know, Boimler geeking out over the tricorder, all kinds of fun stuff like that. They do talk about sort of the difference. You know, we always talk about traveling back in time. You know, if Marty McFly went back, 35 years like he did from 1935 to 1955, now that would be 1993, and you're like, well, that hurts. But they talked about, you know, the difference. How would they feel on Strange New Worlds crew if they went back to see Archer's Enterprise? And so they mention Mayweather as this amazing inspiration for Ortegas. They mentioned Sato as this huge inspiration for Uhura, just like in turn, Uhura is a huge hero for Mariner, and Spock is a huge hero for Boimler. I thought that was really a nice way to sort of pay it forward across the generations in the different shows. And sort of get a reference to those characters. And they also, they mention at one point the Domjot set. And of course, Domjot, anybody who's an TNG fan remembers infamously, you know, play Domjot human. You know, so that one always comes. Every time somebody says Domjot, I immediately flash to that, the big giant scary Nausicaans versus spry young Picard.
Yeah, they definitely had that. I think with the Star Trek Enterprise crew mentions, they, I think, also tied it into resolving the plot as well, right? Of having, oh, you know, the Horonium we can get is from a piece of the Archer Enterprise that is in this Enterprise, as is tradition, to carry on the lineage of the starship name. So
yeah,
it was more than just mentioning those folks. I felt like it was rather intentional to make that part of the plot resolution. Also for my Easter egg, it's not exactly an Easter egg because like you probably will notice it if you're not really quick on the draw here. But I will say it is irresponsible for the folks at Paramount Plus to put the skip intro button on the this intro, because I did skip it because like, oh, because it starts dark, right? I'm like, yeah, whatever, Enterprise lights up, I've seen it a million times, let me get through this. And then I saw the last like 2 or 3 seconds. I said, wait a minute, is that an animated Enterprise? So now I had to go back and say, oh, they redid the intro in Lower Deck style for this show. So I don't blame the folks who made the show. I blame the folks who hosted the show, saying like that's irresponsible. Give like a little bit of an extra buffer there so people decide, do you want to see this special thing, because it's not the normal intro.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, it's a good call. It was definitely it was fun. I mean, again, was it necessary? No. Was it like tremendously additive? No. But was it fun? Yeah, of course it was. It was super fun to see them take that, you know, intro, which we've talked about as one of the sort of better ones, and do it in the animated style. And even they even chucked in a few, like, looks like a few Lower Decks jokes in there as well, right?
I think you had the like jellyfish octopus thingy sucking on the on the nacelles.
Funny. The quotes, my God, the quotes. This, there, you could have done 100 quotes from this episode. At one point I just sort of kind of gave up a little bit and was just like, okay, that was funny, but I can't write them all down. But I do have a bunch. Do you want to do your quotes first?
I feel like mine is pretty prescient. As soon as I heard this one, I said, I bet you this is what this episode is going to end up being about. And it wasn't completely accurate, but it's in line with what happened. So Tendi, who says, not everyone was a pirate, somebody had to make the starships, which ended up being pretty important for this episode.
Yeah, absolutely, that was definitely a good one.
And it it goes in line with like a sort of funny thing where, you know, we talked about probably Strange New Worlds or possibly Discovery. I don't know when we decided to talk about, hey, by the way, there's some stuff that this is of an era that would be a little bit problematic in this modern era. And, you know, good old wonderful Captain Pike is kind of a little bit offensive from Boimler's point of view of like, let's not say that at the dinner table anymore. Like we don't say that all Orions are pirates, kind of thing, right? Like, you know, probably reasonable at the time, but now kind of unreasonable perspective of like, you know, this is a hero for Boimler, and he's like, oh, I didn't need to hear him say that, although I kind of understand of like, well, that's kind of the way people thought back then. And they didn't step away from that. Again, they kept the characters in character, where surely Pike would be, you know, very reticent to trust Orions, because Orions are all pirates. It's all they've ever known from that era. And we know that by the time the Lower Deckers come of age, that like, no, like it's totally fine and normal. Certainly Tendi struggled even with that that era, but you clearly didn't say like, oh yeah, like Orion slaves girls or Orion pirates kind of thing anymore.
Yeah, No, it's actually a really good commentary as well, right? Like, obviously, we live in the post-woke world where, you know, times are changing. You gotta, you know, change your perspectives. You can't, you know, use the old terminology that you used before just because that's how you've always said it. Yeah, definitely kind of landed that one well.
What sort of things did you have for your quotes?
I had, yeah, some good ones. So even just starting from the basics with Rutherford, do you think there'll be tachyons? I can't wait to measure some freaking tachyons. Just made me realize how much I miss those characters. I'm looking forward to the new season. Boimler says, disappointing Uhura would be cool. I wish I could disappoint Uhura. one of my favorites was, help, the portal's trying to portal me. Which, all right, fair point. The thought of assigning intelligence to chance struck me as ridiculous. That's when Spock smiles and laughs and freaks Boimler right out. And the line from Pike that you mentioned, I feel like I'm trying to stop a toddler from knocking over the furniture, talking about Boimler. In the future, his birthday's a holiday. Crap, Boimler. Like, you can't stop giving away the secrets of the future. When they go to the bridge and Boimler says, well, I can figure out a way for us to track the Orions, but, like, you guys shouldn't have this technology, so, you know, how about you just don't look? And Una says, we can't just not look, can we? Like, he makes them all turn the other way while he monkeys around with the station. That was very funny. Look, I'm going to keep this 100% profesh, but I was thoroughly unprepared for how hot young Spock was going to be from Mariner. That line killed me. No, I'm not living off the grid anywhere. I thrive on the grid. I require grid from Mariner when they're talking about having to be stuck in the past. And how am I supposed to have fun when I know I have to become this universally known, super translating, unflappable, hardworking badass from Uhura? That was, again, I like that they mixed in the humor with the Strange New Worlds characters, right? It wasn't just over and over again, you know, Boimler and Mariner. Of course, they had the best lines. They're funny. Their show is funny. They are there to provoke the funny, but it was fun that they mixed in the other ones as well.
I guess one of those that I didn't get the exact quote, but it was like, I think Boimler says, holy Q, and Mariner says, yes. Oh, they didn't meet Q yet. They had like a Trelane thing going on.
That's right. Yeah, it's a good Trelane reference. That's a good Easter egg. We didn't flag that one. That's good. Yeah, for sure. And then the big question I have from this one. So there was an undercurrent to this one. And I think the only point really where this episode got a little serious was around the conversation Boimler has with Chapel, saying, well, we need Spock to be, you know, I think I broke Spock. I made Spock laugh. What if I've ruined the future by making Spock laugh? And Chapel says, no, this is who he's been the last little while. And we know that from watching the episodes that he's sort of embraced his human side while having this affair with Chapel. And then, you know, we sort of see the after effects of that, where she's sort of taking it hard that she knows that what they have is really kind of temporary. She knows that he is going to eventually return to his sort of more stoic ways, logical and everything else. So my question was just, you know, is this the thing that sort of starts to slide Spock back into being Spock? You know, obviously it's been fun this season to watch Ethan Peck, you know, smile. The smiles in this episode were hilarious, but it'll be interesting to see if we start to see the return of serious Spock over the next few episodes.
Yeah, I had a similar-ish question of, like, what's up with Spock? Is this trying to make it seem more like the cage, the menagerie? You know, that twisted sort of history of, like, smiley, happy Spock. Is this a nice way to blend in that part of continuity? I am wondering if that's where they're going with it, too. Because they know they have to set him in a particular spot, but they also were completely unafraid to do was it last season where it was like last time on and it's a completely different actor playing Pike pretend that this 1960s era TV is in line and in continuity and just like, you know, just hit your TV set because the reception's coming in a little fuzzy kind of thing.
Yeah Well, overall, I mean, continuing what has been a really, really great season of Strange New Worlds, it was very strange that they dropped this on a Saturday evening at Comic-Con. That was definitely unexpected. Particularly interesting because they did announce that they're doing the Saturday drop, and then they're coming right back to, we thought that we would be sort of a 10-day gap in between episodes, but they're coming right back this week with another episode. So we're kind of ending up a little sooner than we thought we would, but it was a fun surprise and a damn funny episode. And I think what I took away from this one was I'm really looking forward to the next season of Lower Decks, because I really miss the energy, and it was really fun to watch Jack Quaid and Tawny Newsom bring that to their actual, physical performance, as well as their amazing voice acting that they do on that show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I guess we'll move on to our watch list. Jaime, what do you got for us on the watch list this week?
I have Futurama, which I think you had mentioned before, but it actually came out. I watched that episode on Monday, I want to say, is when the episode dropped on Hulu in the US, and I'm going to assume it's Disney Plus in Canada and elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you think of the episode? I'm curious. I watched it. I watched it today, so I'm curious to hear what you think.
I feel like it was a fine episode where it kind of seemed like the main premise was to be a bridge from how the last time this series got canceled, which was not the first time it got canceled. It was kind of the meta thing of after time gets rebooted, the show gets rebooted as well. Right. And you catch up with what's going on, maybe through a dangerous binge, which was the main sort of scheme here of Fry trying to binge all bazillion episodes of All My Circuits.
Yeah.
So it's a little hard to judge the tone and where things are going. Certainly it feels like the characters are right in line with what I expect. They brought back, I think, every voice actor that I could recognize, and the same folks seem to be involved, so we'll have to see. But I think if you were maybe nervous about it, it didn't feel out of place. Like if you didn't know that the show had gone on extended hiatus, if we called it that, if you're in the future and you're binging right through Old Man and Old Woman Fry and Lita, this may not seem like a huge event. It might be like, oh yeah, whatever, that's just the next season.
Yeah it was I felt a little conflicted about this one, because it wouldn't say it was the strongest episode, and I wouldn't say it was necessarily the best episode first foot forward for a reboot. Although, again, I think if you're tuning into season, they're essentially calling this season 11, episode one. I think if you've watched all the 10 previous seasons, it just sort of, it's all going to fit in and it's fine. This one was, I mean, obviously they were hitting on a few different things here. They were hitting on sort of the meta of it all really hard. I thought maybe just a smidge too hard at times. You know, the whole, the binging and just sort of the way that television works and some of that stuff. But that being said, even just some of the silly gags, the Zoidberg of it all, the Bender of it all, and stuff like that, it was fun to have those characters back. I'm not gonna poo-poo having it back, just because I dig it. The part where Fry looks into the camera and says, yes, you must watch at least 10 episodes of a series, and every series must be canceled every three to four years. And, again, it was obviously very on the nose, but it was well done. I'm looking forward to it. I'm glad they're rolling it out slow too. I didn't know what the sort of release strategy was for it, but it sounds like they're going to do 10 episodes over 10 weeks. And so it'll be nice to sort of have it doled out a little bit, as opposed to just a sort of binge drop landing on us all at once. So I'm looking forward to that too. I had for the watch list this week, we mentioned the Invincible Adam Eve special that dropped on Amazon Prime. We both watched that. It was very in tone with the Invincible series, but it's been a long time since the Invincible series debuted, so I think even I was sort of catching up. And I've read Invincible from when it first came out, and have reread it since, so I'm very into that universe. But even I was sort of like, okay, where are we again? Okay, what had happened? Where did we leave off? And like, oh, and luckily it really is a standalone story. You don't really have to have a lot of deep memories of the rest of the Invincible universe. It does kind of work as a standalone sort of origin story of this young woman and sort of where she starts from and where she ends up. But it did remind me, I was like, oh, that's right. Invincible takes itself very seriously. It's not like a kid's cartoon. It's not Lower Decks. It's not having, you know, there's some humorous bits in it, but it's bloody and gross and violent and stuff as well. So, but I enjoyed it. And it sort of whet my appetite. I was like, oh man, November, I have to wait till November to see more Invincible.
Yeah. Yeah. I watched this one as well. I also think that it's a nice additive thing. I think if people miss out on it, maybe something in season two gets tied in and called back, but I don't think you'll be very likely to have missed out on the whole picture. It adds some more flavor, some more backstory to Adam Eve. And they even did a little, I don't know, was it mid-credits callback to, like, meanwhile, this is where Mark Grayson was at the same exact time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
No superpowers, irritating Omni-Man on levels he can't understand kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. There's a lot of sort of retroactive foreshadowing, but it definitely, it is an additive thing. You're right. Like, if you choose not to watch this, or you don't make the time for it, or if you watch it later on, it'll give you more context, but it is a nice sort of standalone piece. Adam Eve, of course, for the comics readers, she's a very prominent character as the story continues. So you'll appreciate knowing more about her as time goes on. But at this point, it's a nice to have, not a need to have.
On Amazon, for me, this showed up weird. It is something that I'm pretty sure I've seen happen before, where, you know, their catalog is largely based around seasons, right? Here's season one, episode one through whatever. This one shows up as season 202. Which is a weird one, because if you took it literally, it'd be 202. But I think they're trying to make room for the actual season two, and then probably will retroactively give this some designation that makes sense. And it makes me wonder, given the gap that you talked about, so I wonder if any other character will get a similar one-shot as sort of a little bit of a teaser going into the, not the season in this case, but the mid-season. So coming out of the mid-season break, maybe a few weeks before, hey, don't forget, this is coming back, and here's like the same thing, but for Rexplode. What was Rexplode like when he got his powers, sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's the one thing I really enjoyed about the Invincible story in the comic books is how filled out Robert Kirkman made it. There is a ton of characters. They really built a universe over the course of doing this series for well over a decade. They really added in a lot of, you know, really fun, interesting, some of them obviously a little derivative, but deliberately so, homage-y characters. But there's a lot of characters in the Invincible universe, and they spun off a lot of them into their own little stories and stuff like that. And I'll be super excited if they can start weaving some more of those in there and give us a little more context. There's some really good digressions in the Invincible series and side series and stuff like that that would make for really cool television animation. So you're right. I think there's a real opportunity there if this resonates, but it's hard to say, obviously. Last thing on my list was obviously Oppenheimer. Went and saw Oppenheimer. I thought it was a masterpiece. I thought it was incredible. It is an absolutely breathtaking movie to begin with. And then you step back for a second and realize there's not a single shot in the entire 3-hour movie that is CGI. Not one. That is incredible.
The atomic bomb and stuff, like, that's an area where I've just assumed they would go the CGI route.
No, they did it. Apparently, they did it all with practical effects. And yeah, apparently, the only thing that is CGI is in some international markets, particularly I think places like the Middle East and India. They have added some clothes back on to Florence Pugh, because there's a scene in the movie where she's nude, and I guess that prolonged nudity was not considered culturally appropriate in some of these areas, so they've they've covered her up. But other than that, if you watch it here in North America, there is not a single shot in 3 hours of CGI in a movie about the development of the nuclear bombs in the 1940s, which is incredible to say. So all the explosions, all the sort of, you know, all the things that happen in the movie are all practical effects. It's incredible when you step back from that. And beyond that, it's just, it's a real tour de force. Cillian Murphy is an absolute standout as Oppenheimer. Tremendous performance. I'd be absolutely shocked if he wasn't one of the favorites for the Oscars next year. I think this one is going to be complete Oscar bait. There was a ton of performances in there that were standouts. Robert Downey Jr., you know, he's kind of struggled to find his footing since stepping away from the Marvel universe. And this was somebody who was considered a serious actor sort of prior to doing that. And obviously he did bring a lot of good acting quality to the Marvel universe, but it's nice to see him have a real standout performance in this. He is a really, really captivating character in this movie as well. Florence Pugh was great. Emily Blunt was great. Matt Damon was great. There are just so many strong performances in here. And then, you know, Nolan's movies can be a little plodding. You know, due respect to my son, who's the number one fan of our podcast, as well as Christopher Nolan. Sometimes Nolan movies I find can drag a little bit, especially because he tends to make very long films. This one breezed, boy, you know, for a 3 hour movie, it really kind of moves. You know, there is sort of three, you know, it's a standard sort of three act play, but, yeah, it's a really good watch. I highly recommend. And again, I think I was talking with my wife about this earlier and saying, you know, well, I can't decide if I want to see the Barbie movie in the theaters, if it's a theater movie for me, but I will say Oppenheimer is definitely a big screen movie. I'm very glad we got to see it in the 70 millimeter manner in which it was intended by Christopher Nolan. We saw the sort of the film version as opposed to the digital version. I don't think it'll quite have the same heft when you watch it on a home screen, just because it's big. It just feels big, and it feels the size of it lends to its gravitas. It was, it's really something.
Very cool. Very cool. And you, it sounds like you explicitly decided not to participate in the meme, the Barbenheimer meme, which I won't discount. You know, I don't know if it's a significant percentage, but there are definitely people who actually intended to buy tickets for both and watch both. There were analysts talking about that on TV. So,
yeah.
So the JPK household decided not to participate in the meme, even if you weren't fully jazzed on seeing the Barbie movie.
Yeah, it's a temptation for sure. Again, I have read some pieces and I've listened to a couple of pods over the last week with, you know, people whose opinions I respect, who say that, you know, there is as much artistic vision in Greta Gerwig doing Barbie as there is in Christopher Nolan doing Oppenheimer. You know, obviously different type of movie. One's a drama, one's a comedy. But I'm tempted. I'm 100% going to watch the Barbie movie. It's just a matter of whether I will make the effort to go see it in the cinema or whether I'll just, you know, wait for it to come out on my home screen. But yeah, I think it's, again, I really we talked about it a little bit before. I like that they're doing something that's original. I like that they're giving people with a vision, people with creative vision, like Greta Gerwig and Christopher Nolan, space to still do these kinds of movies. These both were not cheap. They were both lots of production, and they are both, you know, again, I'm just obviously extrapolating from other people's perspectives, both really great performing pictures and great pieces of art. And I hope that they just continue to rake in the dough so that the producers who put their money behind these movies will put more money behind these and not just keep rolling out the tentpoles that I think they think people want. Like, and I say this with respect, you know, the Missions Impossible and the, you know, the Indiana Joneses and the things where they know there's a sort of built-in audience. There was no built-in audience for these other than the, you know, Barbie obviously is an IP people know. Oppenheimer, it's basically, it's Christopher Nolan is what you're buying into. I'm glad they're making these kind of movies and that they're letting these artists be artists and go big on these things.
Yeah, I think, you know, the whether or not Mission Impossible has a number on it, it's a numbered sequel, right? And yeah. Barbie, I'm sure that Barbie 2 is already in production, or at least pre-production. So it may be the beginning of a new franchise, but it's not starting out as a franchise to begin with. This is the first one. It still had to do well. People still had to enjoy it purely for what it is. And I think we can just assume there's not an Oppenheimer 2 or Oppenheimer cinematic universe. what was Einstein doing at the same time? You know, even if he appears in this one, which I assume he does, it's like, well, what was he doing when he wasn't on screen? You know, there's not any of that going on. There's not going to be a Disney Plus show about Einstein. It fills in the backstory of what was going on in Oppenheimer.
We did laugh. So we watched the movie. As I mentioned, one of my cousins came along with us, and he actually works in the movie industry, in the television industry, as a lighting professional. And, you know, we always tend to watch, whether it's Tim and I or Tim and I and my son, we tend to watch the credits because we want to obviously pay respect to the people who put their work into to make these movies. And of course, you feel doubly so when you're sitting there next to a crafts person who works on these movies. You want to make sure that you sit there. And so, of course, you know, we were the last sort of handful of people still sitting there in this IMAX theater when the credits finished up. And, you know, of course, I'll spoil this for everyone. There's no stinger. There's no PS scene. There's no anything. But when the credits finished and they turned the thing off, I said, you know, Oppenheimer will return and Oppenheimer 2, the Oppenheimering, you know, like it's, you know, it's just so funny how, again, these sort of cultural things that become part of your viewing habits where you're like, what are they going to say at the end? What's going to be the teaser? And of course, there's no world in which they're going to do that here, but it was easy to have sport with.
Yeah, the Samuel L. Jackson appearance in the end credits stinger kind of thing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, I think that's going to do it for another episode of SpockCast. So, hey, Jaime, if people want to find you, where can they look?
I'm on Twitter as @DevOfTheHair.
And my name is Jonathan Kulat, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram and Threads as @JPKNews, or you can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/@JPK. And we'll hopefully have another part for this episode, or maybe a second episode this week. So stay tuned. Keep an eye on your podcast subscription platform of choice. We'll have more Trek for you, as they are just going to continue to roll out in Strange New World episodes in an uneven pattern. But until then, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the SpockCast podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the SpockCast website at SpockCast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at SpockCast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpockCast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/SpockCast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spockcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.